We can get started. Yes, you cannot. 5 weeks is not enough, even for a book as small as Root, even it's for true. A parak. That's the Torah is an ever flowing ocean, the Yam HaTalmud, the Yam HaTorah, and it's always, you know, all kinds of new insights. New, we learn what we can. So with that, I want to welcome you and thank you for giving the series today. As you hear, of course, is the concluding of the five-part series. Bakasha, Ilana.
Okay. So I was going to take one moment to share my screen, as usual, and then I will begin. Okay. So we actually have a lot of ground I want to cover today in our last class. And I'm going to try to cover that ground by way of posing a question. And that is, why was the Book of Root written? Right? One of the ways of understanding the themes of a book or the significance of a book is to answer that question. Why did the author of the book write the book? According to Chazal, Megillat Ruh is written by Shmuel HaNavi. That certainly connects to the ideas of the connection to the Book of Shoftim, which they also thought that he wrote. We'll get more into why Shmuel HaNavi perhaps a little bit later. But that's the general question that I want to try to answer. And as we answer that question, I'm hoping to kind of see a little bit of an overview of many of the themes that we've already spoken about, as well as be able to touch on a few of the themes that we had not yet had an opportunity to touch on, all while trying to understand why perhaps the book was written. So perhaps the most famous idea about the Book of Ruth and why it was written is found in the Midrash, in Ruth Rabbah, where it says, Amar Rabbi Ze'era, Migila zo ein ba lo 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 tuma ein ba lo tuma velo tahara velo isur velo heter. Right, the Book of Ruth does not have anything in it concerning purity or impurity, what is forbidden and what is permitted. Although the truth is, we saw that there are a lot of laws in the Book of Ruth, but the point of Rabbi Ze'era is that's not the ikar. That's not what the book is all about. Rather, velama nichteva, why was it written? Lilamedcha kama sachar tov legomlei chasadim. Right, it's a book about chesed. And that's a well-known idea. Everybody knows that the book is a book about chesed. And in the weeks that we've spent learning together, we have certainly spoken a lot about that theme, about all of the many acts of chesed that we see throughout the Book of Ruth. But if you look at what Rabbi Ze'era is saying, he's not simply saying that the Book of Ruth teaches us about the beauty of chesed or the importance of doing chesed, but specifically, lelamedcha kama sachar tov legomlei chasadim, right? To teach us the greatness of the reward for acts of loving kindness. Not just that doing chesed is important or beautiful or whatever, but that you have great reward for doing acts of chesed. And that, according to Rabbi Ze'era, is the purpose of the Book of Ruth, to teach us that lesson. So in addition to having noted the many acts of chesed in the book, we've also seen, right, that this very idea, right, that doing acts of chesed bring about other acts of chesed, right? Chesed goreret chesed, as it were, right? That if you do an act of chesed, then that will lead to another act of chesed, which will lead to another act of chesed. And we saw that throughout the book of Ruth. Also, we touched on the idea how chesed is connected to being blessed, right? All of the brachot that somehow are paired together with the acts of chesed, so that chesed, kindness, brings along blessedness, right? That it brings bracha into the world. And we also saw, kind of tied into the idea of chesed, gorer chesed, that chesed kind of brings along more chesed, is the idea that acts of chesed are mutual. If you do chesed, then chesed will be done for you in return. Not because the people who do chesed in the book are asking for chesed in return, but that's just the natural reaction of the people who have seen or have received the chesed. And we talked about that at length in past weeks. And so this idea that Rabbi Zeir is presenting is quite obvious in the book of Ruth. Another way that is somewhat more subtle, perhaps, this idea not only of chesed specifically, but of the idea that there is great reward for doing acts of chesed, is seen through the idea of names in the Megillah. This is something we've kind of hinted to throughout the past classes together, but now I want to kind of look at it in its own right. The significance of names comes up throughout the book of Ruth, and perhaps the most obvious and strong place where the idea of a name and the importance of names comes out is in the act of Geula, that by not so much the field but by marrying Ruth and continuing the family of Naomi, then they are going to that prevents the name of Elimelech's family from being lost. And this, of course, as we've discussed, is found in this idea, which kind of brought up in the Book of Ruth, as we've discussed, of Yibum. So I didn't bring this in the past, but I want to take a look at it now. Right, the idea if somebody dies, if a man dies childless, then his widow marries deceased. Right, if there are brothers who live together and one of them dies, uben in lo, and he doesn't have a son, lo tihye eshet hamet hachutza li'ish zar. The widow will not marry an outsider, but rather will marry the brother, as I said. And the firstborn child to this couple will take on the name of the deceased. So that his name will not be erased from Yisrael. And then it goes on to explain that if the man does not want to do this, so then you do chalitza. Right, the woman should go to the sha'ar, to the gate, and this is precisely what we see in Megillat Ruth in Perek Dalet. They go to this kenim, the elders in this gate of the city, say that my brother-in-law refuses to uphold the name of his brother in Yisrael, lo avayivmi, doesn't want to perform yibum. V'karu lo ziknei iro v'dibru elav, he's called by the elders. V'amar lo chasafti lekachta, and he says, I don't want to marry her. Right, this of course is reminiscent again of Ploni Almoni. V'nikshay yivimto elav leinei eskinim v'chaltzana alo. There's this interesting procedure where they have to take off the shoe, and v'yarka b'fanav. And he has to spit. Right. This is what you do to the person who does not want to build up his brother's house. Right. And his name in Israel will forever be known as the one who took off the house of the one who took off his shoe. Right? Clearly, the Torah speaks negatively about this person who doesn't want to do this kindness for his brother. Right? So we see in this mitzvah of Yibum, first of all, again, many of the elements that we see in the story of Ruth, or the opposite. In Ruth, we see many of the elements of Yibum, even though, as we discussed, it's not technically Yibum there. That's what makes it sort of like above and beyond, but not halakha itself. But we see how chesed, in other words, doing a kindness for another person, is intertwined with the idea in the mitzvah of Yibum of responsibility, right? The brother is doing a kindness for his deceased brother, but he is also acting responsibly, right? Keeping the name of his brother alive, and not doing this was seen as something particularly negative. And so this mitzvah of Yibum which of course is connected to the story of Ruth, has many of those elements of chesed and responsibility, and of course the name of upholding somebody's name, the idea of upholding somebody's name. If we saw once before, I think it was in the very first class, right, that in the book of Ruth, we discussed how it's a book of return from Moab to Beit Lechem, and how the word lashuv is a leitmotif of milah mancha in the book of Ruth. So another milah mancha here, again, emphasizing another important message of the book, is the word shem, right? In the two first prakim of Megillat Ruth, the word shem, name, appears seven times, right? Those who, there are some people who discuss the idea of leitmotif, of a milan manchar, like a key word that tells us of a significant theme in a story. They like the idea that it appears in groups of significant numbers, seven being one of those significant numbers. And here we see indeed that the word shame appears seven times in the first two chapters of Megillat Rut. V'shem ha'ish alimelech, v'shem ishto Naomi, v'shem shnei banav machlon v'chilyon. And then later on, v'yisu lahem nashim o'aviyot, shem ha'achat Orpah, v'shem ha'shenit Rut. So the people are all introduced with names, although many commentaries point out that in the first pasuk of the story, they are nameless. V'yihi b'yimei shvot ha'shoftim, v'yihi ra'av ba'aretz, there was a man with no name who was from Beit Lechem, and he goes with his wife and his nameless wife and his two nameless sons from Beit Lechem to Moab. Now their names are introduced, but what happens throughout the rest of the story is finding out, are they going to be worthy, or are they going to merit having their names remembered? That is the question of the book. In Perek Bet, not surprisingly, the word shame is used twice in connection with Boaz, right? In the very first pasuk, Naomi modal isha ish gibor chayel mimishpachat elimelech ushmo Boaz, right? His name was Boaz. And then at the end of Perek Bet, when Ruth comes back with all of the food that she got in Boaz's field, and Naomi sees this kindness that somebody did and asks Ruth, who was it? So Ruth answers, Vatomer la chamota. Naomi asks, Vatomer la chamota, Efo likatatayom va'ana asit yahit yihi makirech baruch. Where did you get all of this food? The one who recognized you should be blessed. Vatageid la chamota atasher asta imo. Vatomer, right? She told her mother-in-law everything that happened. Vatomer, shame ha'isha asher asiti imo hayom, Boaz, right? The one whose field I was in today, his name is Boaz. So in Perek Bet, there's one person who has a name. He's a man with a name, and that is Boaz, right? Not surprisingly, because he is the one who ensures the continuation of names as the story continues. Then in the last Perek of Megillat Ruth, story where everything all comes together and Boaz marries Ruth, and thereby and together they manage to ensure that the name of the family continues. There is once again the appearance of the word shame seven times, right? Countering the seven for what we saw in the beginning of the Megillah. As you can see with the red in front of you, the Hakim shame hamet al nachalato, right? The idea that they've all come together in order to uphold the name of the deceased on in his nachala, his territory, and that repeats throughout the perek. That theme, that is the purpose of what is going on in Perek Dalet. And then when they finally get married, right? It says Vayomru kol ha'am asher bashar v'hazkenim idim. Right, the all the people gathered around bless Boaz and Ruth, and they say, "Yitena Hashem et Aisha haba lebeitech el beitecha ki Rachel uchilea asher banu shtehem et Beit Yisrael va'asechayil be'efrata ukara shem beveit lechem." Right, that is the purpose of this marriage. Right, ukara shem beveit lechem, and then later the women say, "Vatomara na hanashim el Naomi baruch Hashem asher lo hishpit lach goel hayom." Blessed is Hashem who did not deny you a goel, a redeemer. Vayi Vayikare Shemo BeYisrael. So that phrase is something that we're familiar with, right? When you're giving a baby a name, right? You say Vayikare Shemo BeYisrael, whatever the name is, right? But and usually follow, in the way that we use it now, it usually follows with whatever the name, with the actual name that is being given. But here, there's no real naming going on. It's simply saying Vayikare Shemo BeYisrael. That is the purpose, that the name should be used, should be continuing in Yisrael. And then at the very end of the perek, we have, or well, the end, very end of the narrative, there's still a little bit more as we'll see in a moment. Ruth has a baby and she hands the baby over to Naomi. Vatikrena lo hashchenot shem lemar yulad ben leNaomi. Right, the whole neighborhood gets together to name the child. Vatikrena shemo Oved. Right, they give him the name Oved. Hu avi Yishai avi David. Right, so the actual naming of the child that is born, of course, being like the concrete continuation of the family of Naomi. And of course, the idea of the importance of names is emphasized also at the very end of the Megillah, where we have a whole list of names. Ve'ela todot Peretz, Peretz holidet Chetzron, v'Chetzron holidet Ram, v'Ram holidet Aminadav, v'Aminadav holidet Nachshon, v'Nachshon holidet Salma, v'Salmon holidet Boaz, u'Boaz holidet Oved, v'Oved holidet Yishai, v'Yishai holidet David. Right? The Yichus, right? The listing of the names. And of course, leading to David HaMelech, right? So here we have names in both directions, right? We have the names that lead up to Boaz, right? From Peretz, the son of Yehuda, all the way down to Boaz, and from Boaz down to David, right? So it's the continuation of the name, but seeing it from both directions, right? And with that, the book ends, right? So this theme of names is throughout. It's tied up, of course, with the idea of chesed, right? This idea of continuing on the name of another, even if it's not your own name, of responsibility. And it also ties in with the idea of Rabbi Ze'ira, that there is a sachar for doing this act of chesed. And that is seen with the use of names throughout the Megillah. The people generally who have names, they're the ones who end up well. Whereas the anonymous people, they're the ones who become irrelevant. So for example, all of the people whom we spoke about in the course of the classes we had together, the na'ar, right, the overseer in Boaz's field, Ploni Almoni, Mr. Anonymous, right? They are all people who have no names because they become irrelevant. They're not the ones who do the acts of chesed that carry the story and the family along. So their punishment, as it were, is that they are nameless. They don't deserve a name in this story. The one exception in here is Orpah. Orpah goes home, but we know her name. Interesting to know why. It could be because Orpah becomes irrelevant to the story because she goes back to Moab. She's not part of Am Yisrael, and this story isn't really interested in telling us the story of the people of Moab. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility are the people of Beit Lechem, of Am Yisrael, right? So they are the ones who either are named or are nameless, depending on how they act. And the people who are nameless are the ones who no longer matter because they're not the ones doing what they need to do. So that's theme number one, right? The theme of chesed and the theme of the rewards that come from chesed. Another theme and another reason that some people say the book was written has to do with David HaMelech. And this goes back to what we saw earlier about Shmuel Hanavi writing the book according to Chazal, writing the book of Rut. Shmuel, of course, is the anointer of the kings, first Shaul, but then David, right? He's the one who establishes basically the kingdom of David, Malchut David. There would be an interest in extolling the greatness of this kingdom. So on a very basic level, you could see that you could say that the book is basically talking about ancestors of David HaMelech. Again, people, and these are the ancestors of our king, right? So that alone might help explain, that alone might help explain, you know, the purpose of the book, that this is why somebody would write a book like this about the kingdom of David. However, as somebody asked or mentioned at the beginning of class today, there's even a deeper analysis of the ancestry of David alluded to in the book of Ruth, which quite possibly is why, at least according to the reasoning that this is a book about Malchut David, quite reasonably might be why the book was written. And that, of course, has to do with the stories that lead up to that are alluded to in the book of Ruth. We know that David HaMelech has two ancestries essentially that are discussed in the book of Ruth. I'm sorry, if you can excuse me just for 1 second.
I'm sorry.
Technicality solved. There's Boaz, right, who comes from Yehuda, and there's Ruth, who comes from Lot or from Moab. I'm sorry. There's just some noise here that I'm trying to deal with, but we're okay now. Okay. In both of these families, we have certain questions that would have to be addressed in terms of them being the ancestry of David HaMelech. So on Yehuda, on Boaz's side, we have the story of Yehuda and Tamar, as somebody mentioned earlier in the in the class. And in that story, I'll read parts of it together with you now. You have Yehuda, Vayikach Yehuda Isha, La'er bechoro u'shmo Tamar, right? Yehuda, son Er, and he found a wife for him named Tamar. Vayhi Er bechor Yehuda ra be'enei Hashem. He was not good, and Hashem killed him. Vayomer Yehuda le'onan. Yehuda then says to his second son Onan, Bo el eshet achicha v'yabem ota. Go to I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop for 1 moment. I truly apologize.
I really want to be.
I apologize. There's apparently some more rockets falling in the Yerushalayim area. So people were concerned and, okay, focusing again. So Yehuda says to Onan, his second son, Bo el eshet achicha v'yabem ota v'hakem zera l'achicha. So this is a theme that we're used to already. Right? Join with your brother's wife and do your duty by her as a brother-in-law and provide offspring for your brother. In other words, do Yibum. And v'haya imba el eshet achiv v'shichet artzav lebilti natan zera l'achiv. Right? He didn't want to have Tamar become pregnant from him because he knew that the child would not be his, it would be his brother's. Vayera b'nei Hashem asher asa vayamet gamoto. Right? So Hashem was not pleased with this and he kills him as well. Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar kalato, shivi amana vet avich, ad yigdal shela b'ni, ki amar pen yamut gam hu ke'echav. So Yehuda is getting nervous already. He doesn't want his third son Shela to die as well. So he says, you know, Tamar, wait till Shela grows up, go home in the meantime, and wait. Tamar realizes after a while that Yehuda has no intention of giving his third son Shayla to her to marry. So she takes things into her own hands. In the meantime, Yehuda's wife has passed away. So she dresses up, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the story, as a prostitute. She waits by the crossroads and Yehuda comes by. They are together. She becomes pregnant. And she asks as a collateral that he will pay her, that he will send her payment, his staff and his seal. This is basically, you know, the ancient identity card, the Tudat Zehut, a way of identifying Yehuda. Meanwhile, she goes home. Yehuda wants to send payment the next day, but he sends his servant, and the servant cannot find her anywhere because she's not actually usually there. This was like a one-time thing. Vayishlach Yehuda et gedi ha'izim. He sends this goat in order to get back his eravon. He's very interested in getting his identity card back. V'lo mitza'ah. He doesn't find her. Vayishalan et anshei mekoma lemor ayeh hakadesha. He asks, where is the cult prostitute, the one who was here? And they say, Lo hayta bazeh kedesha. They're like, we don't know what you're talking about. There is no such woman. Vayashov Elihuda vayomer. The servant comes back and says, Lo mitzatia, I have not found her. Vegam anshei makom amru lo hayta bazeh kedesha. Right, so he comes back and says, I can't find her. Yehuda then says to the servant, okay, let's forget about it. Pen nihye lavuz. I'm going to end up being a laughingstock. I'm going to be embarrassed if I keep walking around looking for this prostitute. Let's just drop the subject. I'll give up my identity card, as it were. Eventually, it comes out a few months later that Tamar is pregnant. Yehuda immediately says that she has to be killed because essentially she was betrothed to Shela, so she must have done some sort of act of prostitution. And as she's being taken out to be killed, she takes out the chotemet and the ptil, and she says to him, the person who is the father of the child is the one to whom these belong. Yehuda realizes what has happened, right? Back to the psukim. He mutzet v'hi shalchal chamia lemor la'isha sher ela lo anochi hara. Right? I'm pregnant from the man to whom these belong. V'tomer hakerna lemi achotemet v'aptilim v'hamatea ela. To whom do these belong? V'yaker Yehuda v'yomer tzadka minu'meni. She says she is more righteous than I, right? He admits that she is correct and he was not. Ki al kein lo netati al shela v'ni v'lo yasaf od l'data. Right? Because I wasn't acting responsibly, I wasn't giving Shayla to her to marry, so she, because of that, she did this, and they did not get together ever again. And then, v'hi be'et l'idata v'hinei te'omim b'vitna. She has twins, So the one child of the two twins puts out a hand. The Mialdel identifies the child that's whose hand it was. Vayhi ki meshiv yado, the hand came back inside. Vayhi yatza achiv, vatomer ma paratzta alecha peretz, vayikra shemo peretz. Right, the other child was named Peretz. This, of course, is Peretz that we see at the end of the Megillah, who is the descendant of Boaz, who also, is the ancestor of Boaz, who eventually leads to Boaz and then David, but is also the one whose name is mentioned in the blessing to Boaz and Ruth, right? That they should build a house as did Peretz, right? So evoking clearly this story of the birth of Peretz. Okay, so what do we see in this story? And I'm rushing through it, I apologize. It's just a lot to teach and not so much time. We see in the story, once again, a story about taking responsibility. There's much more that can be mined from the story on that topic. But Yehuda is a man who first doesn't take responsibility by not allowing Ruth to marry Shelah, right? So not taking responsibility for his son, right? Not allowing Shelah to do Yibum for his other son. But then when Ruth becomes pregnant, right, by taking these matters into her own hands, he once again does not take responsibility until she basically forces him to take responsibility. And at that point, he says, Tzadka mineni. So Yehuda does learn the lesson that Ruth is trying to teach him about responsibility for the family. Again, like I said, a lot more that could be mined out of this story. Yehuda, as we see later on in Sefer Bereishit, truly learns responsibility, and there are lots of echoes of this story later on, which unfortunately we don't have time to go into right now, not particularly relevant for Megillat Rut. But Yehuda's lesson he has learned here is responsibility. It is through this idea of continuing the name of somebody who is deceased, taking responsibility, doing that chesed. But what happens in the story is that Tamar has to go to extreme measures in order to make this happen, right? She has to basically sleep with her father-in-law in order to produce an heir so that the family name can continue, right? Generally speaking, if you look at commentaries, this is seen as a positive act that Tamar did, even though it is was brought about in a way that I would venture to say would ordinarily not be seen as a positive thing to do. But in this case, she did the right thing in order to push Yehuda in the right direction and also to continue on the family of Yehuda. I didn't bring here the story of, on the other side of the family, the story of Ruth's ancestors, which we talked about in previous classes, where the nation of Moab is brought about through a not identical, but in some ways similar story, where the daughters of Lot get Lot drunk in order that they can have a continuation of their family, thinking that there's nobody else that they can have children with. Clearly, much more problematic even than the story of Yehuda and Tamar, because we're talking about fathers and daughters, not daughters-in-law and fathers-in-law. And that leads to Moab with all of the problems that we have discussed at length. And then we come to Megillat Rut. And in Perek Gimel of Megillat Rut, we have a story that on the one hand is very reminiscent and clearly addressing those two stories. And on the other hand, a story that is entirely different than those two stories. So at the beginning of the Perek, Vatomer la Naomi Chamota, right? Naomi turns to Ruth, now that she understands that Ruth has been in the field of Boaz. Biti halo avakesh lach manoach asheri tavlach. I want to seek a home for you. Va'ata halo Boaz modatanu. Boaz is our relative. Asher hayit et narotav, the one whose narot you were with. Hine hu zoret goren hasorim halayla. Right? Today he is out in the goren, in the threshing floor with his seorim, right? Remember, this is in the harvest time. I want you to bathe and anoint yourself and get dressed up and go down to the goren, right? So far, this story is quite reminiscent of what we've seen in those other stories. But don't make yourself known to him until he has had food and drink. And then, note the place where he is sleeping. Uvat vigilit margelotav, right? You should go and uncover his feet, vishachaft, and lie down. And he'll tell you what to do, right? So this is a story that very much reminds us, right, of the other two stories, right? She is supposed to wait until Yehuda has drunk, quite possibly something that has, you know, alcohol, like in the story of Lot. At the very least, we have a very tired man who she is supposed to come while all dressed up to surprise in the Goren. So you might have to wonder, what is Naomi doing here? Is it possible that she was basically setting Boaz up the way that Yehuda was set up, right? Trying to force him to have a relationship with Ruth, right? To produce an heir right then and there? Or is something else going on? Regardless of what Naomi's intention was, and it could really go either way, you could say that she was doing, you know, again, another example of Eit Lasot Lashem Heferu Torotecha, you know, desperate times called for desperate measures, that she was saying, this has to be done, and therefore we're going to follow in the footsteps of the righteous Tamar and do a similar kind of thing. Or it's possible that she is sending her down to get his attention, but not necessarily in the same way that Tamar did. whatever her intentions were, we see what the reaction of Boaz was. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla, in the middle of the night, v'yacharad ha'ish v'yilafet, v'hine isha shochevet margalotav. Right, Boaz wakes up suddenly and there's this woman sitting, sleeping at his feet. He's surprised. Vayomer mi'at, who are you? V'tomer anochi rut amatecha uferasta chanafecha al amatcha ki goelata. Right, I am Rut. You have to be the goel. And then, as we've read before, Vayomer bruchat la Hashem biti, you are blessed. This chesed that you were doing is even greater than the first chesed you did of helping Naomi find food. Right then, it was a temporary solution to help her survive, but this is a solution that's going to help continue the family forever. Right, I will do whatever you ask. Because I know what a tremendous person you are. Right? And this is we discussed before. He's saying, but I cannot do this. I cannot be your goel right away because there's another goel instead. Right? So what happens here in the threshing floor of Boaz's field? Basically nothing except a promise from Boaz to help. Right, so while we might have expected the outcome to be similar to those two other stories, this story has the same outcome, but it rids the story of any of the possible problematic elements. So you have Boaz taking the responsibility, like we saw Yehuda eventually do in his story, but he does it in a way that again clears any of the possible problematic elements of the story out. And he takes it even a step further. If in the beginning parts of the story we saw of Yehuda's story, we saw him running around trying to pay Tamar and eventually says, well, let's just drop it because I'm going to get embarrassed. So what does Boaz say to Ruth here? Lini halayla, sleep here. V'haya baboker im yigalech tov. Yigal. V'im lo yachpot legalech ugaltich anochi. Right? Stay here tonight, and tomorrow we will see if the other Goel wants to do the Geula. If not, I will do it. In the meantime, sleep. Vatav ad haboker. She slept at his feet, where she had laid down before, until the morning. Vatakom b'terem yakir ish et re'ehu. She gets up before it was light enough for people to recognize each other. Vayomer, why? Because Boaz says, al yivada ki va'a ha'isha ha'goren. Nobody should know that a woman had come down to the goren. Whereas in the beginning parts of the story, we see Yehuda trying to protect his own name, meaning he's trying to not to embarrass himself. Here, Boaz goes out of his way to make sure that Tamar is not embarrassed, that Ruth is not embarrassed, that she can walk out of there with a clean name. And so this scene in... As I'm sure that many of you can guess, there are some commentators who try to say that things did happen in the Goren and the Megillah is just not telling us. I'm not convinced because the Torah has no problem telling us when these things happened. Here it seems to me it's Boaz imitating the behavior of Yehuda, but in the best way possible, right? The end of the Yehuda story without its beginning. And that is what leads to the Gula. And that is what basically the book is coming to tell us, that the ancestors of David HaMelech are come from Yehuda and Moav, but look at the family members of Yehuda and Boaz and Moav that he comes from. The best that you can possibly have of these two. You have Ruth, who basically is the flip side of all the negativity of Boaz, as we've learned in previous classes, and Yehuda and Boaz, who is the descendant of Yehuda, who takes all of the good from Yehuda after he is taught the right way that he is supposed to behave. And this is what was the founding, this is what founded the kingdom in of David HaMelech. Those are the main explanations for why the book of Ruth was written. But there's another question, which in the last minutes that we have, I would like to address, which is a related question, but not exactly the same, which is not why was the Book of Ruth written, but why do we read the Book of Ruth on Shavuot? So some of this, of course, connects to the things that we've just spoken about. For example, there is a Midrash. It appears, among other places, in the Yerushalmi and Masechet Chagigah, which states that David HaMelech was both born and died on Shavuot, right? So this is a holiday that is connected to David HaMelech. I mean, that's why we read about his ancestors. Could be. That's one explanation that is given, excuse me, for reading it on Shavuot. Another explanation that is given is, as we've seen, the story of Shavuot, the story of Megillat Ruth takes place during the time period of Shavuot, right? Starting with the barley harvests around Pesach time, but through the period of the harvest of what we now call the period of Sfirat HaOmer, ending with the holiday with the time period of Shavuot, the Ksir Chitim, right? So it is a story that takes place during this time period, and therefore it's appropriate to read it on Shavuot. But another, you know, possibility of why that book was chosen for this holiday. There are two other reasons, however, which I think gets more to the crux of the issue of why this book is so appropriate for this holiday. And the first idea is that it goes back to the Midrash of Rabbi Zera, that this is a book all about chesed. The holiday of Shavuot, at least one aspect of the holiday of Shavuot, right, Chag Matan Torah, is the Torah, the holiday where we celebrate the giving of the Torah. That we take upon ourselves again these laws by which we live our lives, that guides our lives. But as Rabbi Zera points out, this is a book that deals essentially not so much with the laws, although again, there are laws that appear there, but with chesed, right? And we saw extensively that these acts of chesed are all about doing not the din, not the thing that you have to do, but doing the lifnim mishurat din, going above and beyond what you must legally do. And so perhaps the Book of Ruth is read on Shavuot together, or you know, with the Torah readings about Matan Torah, about the giving of the Torah, to say that the giving of the Torah, of course, is important, but it must come together with the Book of Ruth. It has to come together with the Din. Has to come together with the Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. The keeping the laws has to come together with the Chesed, and those two things together, right? The law and the spirit of the law, if you want to put it that way, are together how we are supposed to live our lives, not just one and not just the other. So the Book of Ruth kind of complements fills up that full picture of how we are supposed to live our lives. One last idea is perhaps the flip side of Rabbi Zera. Right, Rabbi Zera said, maybe I'll go back to that first Midrash, that it's a book not about Tuman Tahara, not about Isur and Teter, but about Chesed. And I think that is true, which is why I've spoken so much about it. But I think that when it comes to reading it in Chag HaShavuot, it's possible that the flip side is true as well, that the Book of Ruth is specifically a book in which we can actually see people as they connect to, the laws of the Torah. It's an interesting question, the holiday of Shavuot, right? We're all familiar with the idea that all of the Shalosh Regalim have two aspects to them, the aspect which is more agricultural and the aspect which is more, I'll say, historical, right? So as we all know, for example, Sukkot, it's Chag HaAsif, right? It's when the holiday of the ingathering, when we have finished harvesting all of our fruits. And it's also the holiday that commemorates the fact that we all dwelled in Sukkot when we were in the desert, right? So the historical reason and the agricultural reason. Pesach, is also two things. That one is largely historical in the Torah, right? It's a commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt. But even in Pesach, there are elements of the agricultural. It's something that takes place in the Aviv. There's the mitzvah of the Omer. And again, we don't have enough time remaining to go into that in depth, but those two aspects kind of live side by side in the Torah. Shavuot, interestingly, we have two aspects to this holiday. There's Chag Matan Torah on the one hand, right, commemorating the giving of the Torah. But it's also Chag HaBikurim, right, Chag HaKatzir, which is the agricultural aspect, right, the holiday which commemorates, which is a celebration of the harvest, which is a celebration of the bringing of the first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash, right, again, emphasizing the agricultural aspect. What's fascinating about Shavuot is that the Torah itself does not mention it being Chag Matan Torah. That's an idea that's developed by Chazal. This, despite the fact that the dates arguably match up, right? That Matan Torah did take place on or pretty much around the same time that Chag HaShavuot falls out. So it's there. The Chazal aren't pulling it out of the blue, but the Torah does not mention it, which is fascinating. Right? The Torah does not say that Shavuot is the holiday of Matan Torah. In the Torah, Shavuot seems to be purely agricultural. And yet, if you think about Chag HaShavuot more carefully, within the agricultural aspect of Chag HaShavuot, you actually have both sides. An element of Chag Matan Torah, as well as the agricultural festival. When you bring the Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash, when you bring the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves of bread that you have to bring to the Mikdash on Shavuot, this, it's a way of acknowledging, right, that we have made it to the land. We are now living in the land and working our fields and growing our food. But we can do this only by the merit of the fact that we acknowledge that this is all given to us by God, that we were brought here to this land in order that we can now stand before you, bringing you our first fruits. The goal of getting to Eretz Yisrael was always the intended end of the process that started with Yitzhak Mitzrayim. And so while in our mind, we have two different goals when we think about Shavuot, the Omer counts both from the Exodus from Egypt to Matan Torah, but also from the Exodus of Egypt, from the beginning of the barley harvest to the beginning of the wheat harvest, which again, obviously takes place in Eretz Yisrael. So we have these two parallels going on at the same time. I think that in the mitzvah of Bikurim, and appropriate for our class, in the story of Megillat Rut, we have the combination of those two things together. Because ultimately, the goal was never that the people should leave Egypt and dwell forever at Har Sinai. The idea was that they would take the Torah with them and get to Eretz Yisrael and live lives, right, where those two things are intertwined, where they work their fields and they grow their food and they bake their bread, right? But they recognize that all of that was from Hashem, and they recognize it's both by, in the sense of the Bikurim, giving some to Hashem, but also, as we see in Megillat Rut, by sharing it with other people, right? And that is the ultimate goal of receiving the Torah on the way out from Egypt. So that Megillat Rut then is the real story of Chag HaShavuot, the story where the agricultural and Matan Torah are joined together in one very beautiful story. And that is the end of our series for Megillat Rut for this year. As usual, I'm happy to answer any questions or hear any comments that people have.
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, people were commenting the rockets were flying while you were teaching. All right. I don't see any questions in the chat, but if anybody has oral questions, please feel free to speak up.
I have a question.
Okay, sure.
Yes, thank you very much for the series. I greatly enjoyed it. Now, when the person becomes the Redeemer, I know that they give the name of the deceased relative to the new baby. But what about the lands of the deceased? What are they still sitting there waiting for someone to claim them?
In other words, the presumption is that if Yibum is done and there is now an heir for the deceased, so that when that child grows up, he will inherit the land that was intended for that person. In other words, so that would be the heir.
So when Elimelech left for Moab and the land just stayed there for 10 years and nobody touches it?
It's actually a very interesting question, because those psukim in the Megillah, those verses in the Megillah, are very unclear. Like, what exactly was happening to Naomi's field all these years? Because so all of a sudden we realize when Boaz convenes all these people in the gate of the city, we suddenly realize that there's this field. And unfortunately, the wording of the verse is very unclear. Was it being bought back, or was it being bought, or was it still in Naomi's possession, and was it being now bought from her? It's unclear. But there apparently some field there, either unworked all of those years, or somebody else had taken it up. Unworked all those years, and now it was being purchased from Naomi. But ideally, as we saw in the story, by a member of the family, so it can continue to be within the family, or it had been sold off beforehand and now was being bought back to bring it back into the family. But like I said, your question is an excellent one, because the commentaries talk a lot about it, because it isn't at all clear exactly what the nature of that field was, what the status of that field was.
Right, because in the Haftorah of Behar of last week, there actually was, it was with the prophet Jeremiah, and he was in jail, and some cousin of him comes to him in jail and says, you have to redeem my uncle's land, because we are going to sell it off for poverty. But there's a rule that if you are the cousin, you have the first right to purchase it, and then later you are obliged to sell it back to us.
Right. So that's the idea that we talked about it a couple of classes ago, the idea of the goel, right, that the close relative has the responsibility to do what you're describing. All right, and that's right. All explicit in the Torah of laws, you know, from Parshat Behar. Right.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
I wasn't sure. You made a statement about, I think that you were saying that Ruth was metakein, and Boaz was metakein the midos of Yehuda, that Yehuda displayed. What was Ruth metakein? She was metakein whose midos?
In other words, Ruth is from Moab, and Moab has its own, we talked about this, I think, in the first class, Moab has its own list of problematic qualities, because of which the Moabim are not really allowed to marry into Am Yisrael, Ruth being right, the obvious exception here. So first of all, she is the nation of Moab comes out of an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. So that's problem number one. Later on, the daughters of Moab are known for problematic sexual behavior, right? They seduce Bnei Israel, you know, at some point in the desert, the end of Parshat Balak, the beginning of Parshat Pinchas. So that quality seems to have followed in the nation of Moab. And then there's also the story of when Bnei Israel left Egypt and they wanted to pass through the land of Moab. And it says that they did not allow them to go through and wouldn't give them food and water. And that's the reason stated why you cannot marry Ammonim and Moavim, because they weren't willing to do that slight chesed. So Moab is seen as like the antithesis of chesed. You won't even give food and water, which of course, again, also connects back to Lot's connection to stone, because that's where he was living. And the question is, how much was he stomi and how much was he from the family of Avraham, who was known for chesed? So that's what Ruth undoes with her acts of chesed. It's interesting, by the way, if we're already on the topic, another reason that is stated why the Moavim cannot marry into Am Yisrael is because of their connection to Bil'am, right, that Balak, Melech Moav, Balak, the king of Moav, hired Bilam to curse Bnei Israel, right? So if you have a nation who is associated with wanting to curse Bnei Israel, and you're talking about a story where all we hear are brachot, people blessing one another and doing chesed for one another. So that's another connection here where we see roots being the antithesis of the place that she comes from. So she undoes her, essentially, her Moab background and proves that she is worthy, more worthy than many of the people of Am Yisrael during her time period to enter the nation.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Can I ask you something?
Deb, go ahead.
Yeah, assuming Shmuel wrote Megillat Rut, why does, when he gives the genealogy, does he stop at Peretz and doesn't include Yehuda?
Interesting question. Yeah, I saw that was in the chat.
My question.
Yes, I see that. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure. How's that? I don't know. I know that in some parts of Sefer Shmuel, there are hints to certain animosity between the Peretz branch of the family and the other branches of the family, like the Zerach branch of the family. This is just off the top of my head. So maybe when Shmuel wrote it, he was trying to emphasize that it was specifically the Peretz branch of the family that led to David, not Yehuda in general. Why he couldn't include Yehuda as well, I'm not sure. It's a good question.
It's even more suspicious because if he wanted to show the good midas of his ancestry, he would bring in Yehuda to show how honest he was in his admission.
Right. No, for sure. Because Yehuda, that story of Yehuda is for sure part of, you know, Yehuda taking responsibility, showing leadership, you know. Yes. So it's an excellent question to which I do not have an excellent answer. Okay. But I will see
something. To me, it seems very obvious because he was Yehuda got the that was the tribe. So he didn't have to say it again. But my thing that I wanted to say, and I guess the question was sort of ignored, it wasn't a question, but the fact that Shmuel basically was still young and vibrant when he retired, because his job had been to mentor Saul, and Saul was a disaster. So when he deposed Saul and he knew that David would manage on his own, then he went off in his retirement and wrote all those history books.
Okay, yes, I think that makes a lot of sense, for sure. I think, in all of the books that that Chazal attribute to him, are all somehow connected to his work in that, you know, first his work in connection with Shaul, but more significantly with Shmuel. Both the book of not only Ruth, but also the book of Shoftim, which is also attributed to him, which also shows kind of like the disaster before the kingship was established. Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you if we could get the chart that you had last week in your last year.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Different columns.
I thought I'd send that, but maybe I forgot to send it. Sure, I will absolutely send it to you.
We can post it on the website, and no problem.
Did I send that to you last time?
You know, I don't remember. I know you sent the stuff. I'd have to go look on the website. You can look if we got it, it's up on the website. Otherwise, we'll add
okay.
It.
I can send it again just in case.
Thank you. Yeshkaya, it was great. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay. My pleasure. Thank you. Great. Thank you, Ilana. And thank you for the series. And we should hear good news from Israel. It's going through a hard time. Hopefully, yes. What can I say? We hear good things that Shem should help us. We should be strong and united. And we should be blessed with blessings of peace. Okay. Yes. Everybody have be well, be healthy, be safe. Please go out tomorrow morning, Marty Lakshin at 11 o'clock, followed by Lori Novick. Ilana's neighbor, I think, or I don't know, exact neighbor, but the same, both in Efrat, and at that's right at 12:15 on the Woman Kriyat Torah, and then tomorrow night Moshe Sokolov on the Haftorah of the Week, and our shiurim on Thursday Shuli Mishkin, the Parsha Shiur, Rabbi Blackman from Australia, and then Friday morning, please God, my shiur in Pirkei Avot at 9:30. Everybody be well, and I want to thank Ilan again for this series, and all the best everybody, and have Laila Tov and Yom Tov on this side of the Atlantic. Okay, everybody be well. Bye-bye.
Bye. Chag Sameach to everybody.
Chag Sameach, yes.